Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
On today's show, we'll be meeting journalist Jerome Tubiana to hear about his work on the new graphic novel Guantanamo Kid.
Then we'll be discussing the sinister power of sound as we hear from Tom Scott, the director of a new play that plumbs the terrifying depths of audio.
And we'll be learning more about Norwegian national treasure, the artist Harald Soberg, with curator Kathleen Soriano and artist Marille Nudecker, as a major exhibition of his paintings goes on show in London.
That's all coming up. Plus, Monocle's Paige Reynolds will be looking ahead to next week's news today, and we'll enjoy some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Here we are again, Fernando. No finer way to spend a Sunday lunchtime. But let's take a look, Fernando, together at what may lie ahead elsewhere in the world this week. Monocle's own Paige Reynolds is here with her crystal ball.
Everybody's talking from Paige News.
Let's have a look then. What have you got for us?
Okay, well, the first story I have for you is essentially, supposedly, the United States and South Korea are going to begin their annual Key Resolve military drills next week. These drills involve Key Resolve, which is largely computer-simulated exercise, lasts around 12 days, and Full Eagle, which lasts around 8 weeks. These exercises are a key part of the US-South Korea alliance, which is a very historic alliance. However, for the 2019 drills, they were supposed to take place, the Full Eagle specifically was supposed to take place on a reduced scale. Now, this was due to the fallout from the Trump-Kim Singapore meeting. But after Hanoi last week, some are wondering if the fate of these military drills, supposedly going to happen this week, and of sort of Washington's decades-long military alliance with South Korea could be at stake. So Trump has repeatedly asserted that US military deployment in South Korea is too costly and that he may eventually withdraw some of the 28,500 US troops deployed in South Korea. So I think everyone's going to be sort of talking about this next week, about the US-South Korea alliance, and I think that's something that's really going to come out of last week's Hanoi meeting.
Or the meeting that sort of wasn't, or it was.
Exactly.
But it was a lot briefer than everyone was hoping.
Indeed.
Intriguing stuff. We'll watch this space carefully. Where next?
Next, we're going to go across the world to Sydney. Sydney Design Festival, which kicked off on March 1st, will be running until March 10th. Sydney Design Festival has been happening for about 20 years now. This year's theme is accessing design. So it's all about democratising design as much as possible. They're going to be looking at various concerns, including geography, race, gender, socioeconomic issues. And I think, you know, design accessibility is something we're seeing as very much a theme across design festivals and biennales in the past few years. So there's some highlights, my personal highlights, of looking at the upcoming schedule. There's a lot of focus on Indigenous design. There's going to be the MAS, M-A-S, Indigenous Design Symposium, with a focus on the work of women specifically. The festival also will be happening on International Women's Day. And the Indigenous Design Symposium provides sort of a practical platform demonstrating the marriage of sort of Indigenous ways of being, ways of knowing with the modern day. And then another few highlights will actually also be featuring on Monocle's dedicated design podcast in the coming weeks. So our Sydney correspondent will be doing a couple of interviews. One of the interviews we're doing is with Akira Isagawa, who's a very famous Japanese-born Australian fashion designer, and one of Australia's most prominent contemporary fashion designers. And we'll also be interviewing Duncan Meerding, who's sort of one of these very interesting furniture and lighting designers. And he's also legally blind. So I think we'll be talking about kind of how his design practice obviously interacts with that as well. So a lot to look forward to. My final story for the day is Mardi Gras.
Perfect.
So Mardi Gras will be taking place on Tuesday, March 5th.
Do you like a little bit of a carnival?
I do love a carnival. And actually, it's been carnival in Brazil, hasn't it? Indeed.
It's a holiday in Brazil for 5 days, actually. But I do enjoy carnival. But yeah, perhaps too many people like dancing might be a bit.
Yeah,
well, I was
really
going to ask you, Fernanda, how you think. Have you been to New Orleans? Have you been to Mardi Gras in New Orleans?
No, but I would love to go. Apparently, they have an amazing food scene there as well, which is, of course, always a good thing in a city.
But do you think it would stack up as a big old party? Would it measure up to Rio or São Paulo or anywhere else in Brazil at carnival time, for that matter?
I don't want to offend our New Orleans listeners.
But, well, there you go. Fernando's retaining his Brazilian loyalty. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly with Tom Edwards and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Coming next, we're going to hear from Kathleen Soriano and Marila Neudecker about the art of arguably Norway's finest artist, Harald Solberg. Stay tuned. Harald Solberg is one of Norway's best-known painters. His images of the Nordic wilderness have come to help define the nation's artistic sensibility. Indeed, his painting, A Winter Night in the Mountains, is widely regarded as perhaps the national painting of Norway.
And yet, he's not well known beyond Norway's shores. Perhaps a certain Mr. Munch has stolen some of the limelight along the way. But now Dulwich Picture Gallery in London is looking to put that right. Their new exhibition, Harald Solberg, Painting Norway, is the first retrospective of his work here in the UK.
Curator Kathleen Soriano joins us to talk about it. And we also have here artist Marila Neudecker, who has a new installation at the gallery as part of the show called And Then the World Changed Colour, Breathing Yellow. Welcome both to the Monocle Weekly. Kathleen, welcome back indeed to the programme. And let's start with you. Tell us a bit about this idea that Solberg's maybe not as well known beyond Norwegian shores as perhaps he deserves to be. Is that a fair characterisation, do you think?
I think it is a fair characterisation. And actually, one of the things I've always wanted to do in my work in the art world is to broaden this artistic canon that we're familiar with. And it's a perfect match, really, with Dulwich Picture Gallery, because they've got this history, really, of revelatory exhibitions that bring these artists that should be in our minds to our attention. And Solberg's the next one. It's a beautiful exhibition of an artist who's so highly regarded in Norway and really deserves to be better known over here.
Well, and for that exhibition, I mean, did you try to collaborate with other artists such a Marila, which we're going to find out more about your work in a bit. So how was that process of finding other?
I think Harald really needed to be looked at on his own. In Norway, he's really regarded as maybe number two after Munch himself. But he needed a retrospective all of his own to celebrate sort of the value of what he's done, what his contribution to landscape painting really has been. And insofar as working with other artists, I knew that I only really wanted to work with one other artist in the space that we have at Dulwich Picture Gallery. And you only have to look at some of his paintings to immediately start to think about some of the incredible work that Marila has made over the years, particularly her Tank series. And the resonating with the Solbergs is so powerful that it was inevitable that I would find myself at her door breaking it down to get her to engage with this artist who she'd never heard of before.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, Marila, exactly. How do you then approach something like this if it is somebody that perhaps you're not so familiar with, and yet somebody, in this case like Kathleen, who says, look, I see you as such natural bedfellows. Is that funny as an artist to be compared or to be sort of suggested as such an obvious companion? What was that moment like when Kathleen said that to you?
I think it would have been different if I wouldn't have known Kathleen for quite a few years now through a different project that we did in whenever it was 2008 or 2009. Mm-hmm. So our conversation goes back quite a while, and it wasn't the first thing that came to my mind when I looked at the Solbergs and looked at the Dulwich Mausoleum space, and particularly at the light in there and its symmetrical layout and all the sort of John Soane's architecture is amazing in there. So I think we had quite a conversation before I sort of zoomed in on the idea of just one tank will be the most powerful thing to do for this.
But I'd also bumped into you, I remember, at the Peder Balcke exhibition at the National Gallery.
Yes.
Who's another incredible Norwegian artist who people hadn't heard of before, and you were waxing lyrical about him at that point.
Yes. Oh, no, I love Peder Balcke paintings, especially the sketches. That was sort of one of my favourite things. But I did not know Solberg before I spoke to Kathleen about him. So I've kind of looked at him through representations and in online to a degree, but also in books, but nothing in the flesh until I saw the exhibition. And it was such an amazing thing to then see them in the flesh. And I really enjoyed that.
But both your work and Harald as well, they deal with the natural world in such a beautiful way as well. So I can see why perhaps Kathleen thought of you, right, for this exhibition.
I can probably see it now. It's all happened more than in the process in some way. And I guess there was all sorts of other things. I was thinking of going to Norway at some point, wasn't I, to sort of film where he was standing painting and sort of reenact almost sort of, or have a different take on his work as a response. But in some way, with the yellow light in the mausoleum, I think I made the right decision to just kind of work with the image of the forest, very much leaning towards his paintings. And it's not as if that is a new image for me. I have made forest tanks in the past, but this feels like a completely different piece because of the yellow. So I've decided to put this yellow spotlight onto it, which then becomes something quite different. And today it was great to see it with the sunlight coming through and this sort of really intense yellow light in the space and then the yellow in the tank, which makes lots of sense. And then, of course, you look at the Zorberg paintings and he uses a lot of strong colour, a lot of yellow, a lot of sunsets. All those kind of things seem to bounce around if you look at both of those projects.
Well, I find it endlessly interesting to talk or to hear artists talk about light. And straight away you said light when you talked about your impressions of Zorberg's work, Marila. Why do you think that there is such a... Is there a, I don't know what it is, a sort of Nordic or a Northern European sensibility about light? Is it because there's often long hours of darkness? There seems to be such a sort of an interesting conversation around that. Is there a Nordic sensibility perhaps about light, or a European sensibility maybe?
Northern European, you could say, probably, yes. I would have in the past probably picked out Caspar David Friedrich and Christian Dahl and Peter Barker as sort of my influences. In a way, it was a good and interesting process to sort of be confronted with, okay, look at Zorberg, look at the mausoleum. And sometimes that really kind of harnesses how you deal with things and how to approach the project. And in some way, to me, it didn't matter that it was a forest, because I have worked with forests in the past, but this was a very particular one and it was very much tuned in with the situation. And I'm not sure if any other place can replace that context and that particular light and that situation for that tank. So it'd be interesting. I'm not sure if it will go to Wiesbaden, but I should probably not talk about that.
But I think it's also important to remember that in the late 19th century, when Zorberg was painting, artists were really trying to identify what it was that was specific about their national work. You know, you think about the independence that a lot of these countries had found, be it America, be it Australia, and Norway to a certain extent, finding its independence from Denmark. Artists were trying to identify what was the most distinctive quality of their art, of Norwegian art. And a lot of the Norwegian art historians were encouraging artists at this time to focus on the light and that sense of the distinctive qualities of the Nordic light, and particularly dusk and that wonderful blue colour that you get, which tied in so well with everything that the symbolist artists were so fascinated with at the time, that sense of mood, that dreamy time of day, all about spiritualism, about the mystic. It was just perfect bringing everything together, really, that you find in Zorberg's work.
Kevin, I have a question from Harold's work. Which one is exhibited at the Delitzsch Gallery, which one is the most iconic painting? For those who don't know much about his work, but perhaps are curious and, you know, want to check it out.
Well, iconic in his day, I suppose, would be the painting of the Fisherman's Cottage, which he painted in 1906 and was actually exhibited at the Venice Biennale, which was quite something at the time, and now lives in the Art Institute of Chicago. So it's one of the few major works outside of Norway. But iconic today, I would argue that it's Winter Night, which lives in the National Museum in Oslo, which was voted in the 1970s by the Norwegian people as the national painting of Norway. And it's a perfect combination of the monumental landscape that these artists would have been trying to capture in its full sort of spiritual, majestic value, but at the same time, something that has a sense of Norwegian sort of folklore, value, meaning that Zorberg would have tried to have brought to it as well. And to cap it all, it's this incredibly intense sense of blue and white that he imbued the work with. And for Zorberg, colour was so fundamental, like many artists of the time, like Kandinsky or even the writer Goethe, who spoke about it and who Zorberg clearly admired because he carried around two laurel leaves from his grave that he'd collected in Weimar. But colour was all important and it was loaded with meaning and spiritual value for these artists.
Marila, you mentioned that you were looking at the works in books or online. As you sort of researched the man, I suppose, as well, was it important to try and get a sense of what he was like? And actually, Kathleen's already been talking a bit about the sense of mystic. And I guess, is there a sort of a romanticism, a lyricism about him? I don't know, any sort of melancholy about him? Did you feel it was important to try and get that sense of the character almost of the artist as much as of his works?
Always is, inevitably. And in some way, probably as somebody who would have started looking at the sort of sublime painting and romantic paintings, and then to know that there's these sort of bridging artists, early 20th century artists, who would have picked up a lot of these questions and subject matters, if you like. It was interesting to see the Zalbergs kind of creating so much of human interest and so many buildings and even little people in the background, or there's a lot of sort of vistas down the road. And that's one thing that struck me a lot, that there is a lot of architecture that he's painted in his landscapes. Probably my focus was on those classics, the mountains and the forests, because in a way I felt compelled to do that and drawn to those more because I knew I was going to respond to those more. My work rarely includes architectures. Well, it actually does, some of it, come to think of it. but what struck me the most was the colour, I think. Mm. We're talking about the light, but the light and the colour, I think that they are incredibly colourful paintings.
There are some real parallels, I think, that are sort of literal, almost, between Marila's work and Zalberg's. One is this incredible view that she gives us through the trees. And anyone who's travelled through Norway, either by car or train, you get these incredible glimpses through the serried ranks of the pines to the fjords and the little houses. And Marila gives us that in a sort of literal sense. And there's also the colour that she picks up on. But another thing that I find really resonates between the two is this absence of human presence, but a suggested sense of human presence. It's always as if someone has just been there or someone's just walked out of a scene. And allied with that, that sense of fairy tale or folklore. And I always remember Marila telling me that when she first started making the tanks, she used to put tiny human figures in there. And she stopped doing that because it prevented the viewer from imposing their own narrative on these scenes that they would be presented with. And in a way, Zalberg does the same. Yes, he's picking up on a sort of symbolist notion of the dead city being the reflection of the soulscape. And he was also painting at a time when these artists were regretting the loss of spirituality. You know, we had Darwinism, modernism was coming, the telegraph poles, industry. You know, there was a lot of nostalgia and romanticism about the past. So as well as the sort of the literal links with Marila, I think there's also sort of an emotional mood link with those works.
I want to ask a little bit about context. We mentioned briefly the actual, the space and Sir John Soane, one of those great, brilliant old British eccentrics, a favourite of mine. How different is it, Marila, when you have, obviously the context completely informs the work, but you've been artist in residence at Soane, done all sorts of extraordinary things. How different is your approach when you see and experience a space or spaces that are so varied? Or weirdly, does your work find a kind of consistency despite that? What's that process like?
I'm not sure about consistency because there's a sort of, each time there's a sort of very different aspect that either interests me or that somehow asks to be looked at a bit more closely. I suppose recently I've done a lot of sort of tracking shots, either horizontally or vertically, in order to distort the experience of that space that I have. And they do tend to be seen in very particular ways. So in some way, the work always has a very particular relationship between the architecture it sits in and the scale of a human being looking at it, yeah. And that sort of process of perceiving whatever it is. I mean, it could be a video, it could be a tank, it could be both. And in some way, those types of reflections that I was talking about earlier, they're really important to somehow reveal the making of it or your perception of it. It's always that conversation. So there's so many projects. I'm trying to sort of filter out one that is different to the tanks, where you have this sort of immersive experience, which without an image is kind of not fair to talk about.
It's hard. It's a horrible question to be asked on the radio. Kathleen, tell me a bit about your sort of experience of the Dulwich Picture Gallery, because I guess a lot of our international listeners maybe haven't visited, and this can be a call to action to them to do exactly that. But it's an amazing space.
It's an incredible space. I mean, particularly the space that Marila's in, this mausoleum where the founders of the museum are actually sort of entombed. So one has to also create something in that space that is very respectful of what's going on there. And it comes at a natural middle point in the exhibition. So the gallery enfilades on either side have the Harold Sulberg exhibition, but you have this moment of pause that Marila's given us right at the centre. And Sulberg trained as a scenic artist, a decorative artist, so he's very interested in, it's quite a theatrical picture, some of them, they're quite graphic, and you get that sense of foreground, middle ground and background, and that's another thing that you see Marila pick up on an awful lot in her tank, in that foreground, middle ground, background that also shifts as you walk around it, which I think is another strong link between the two. And of course, that allies very closely with notions of the sublime and Caspar David Friedrich again.
The exhibition runs through until June, is that correct?
2nd of June.
So obviously we've had, let's be honest, completely unseasonal sunshine in, here in London this past week. How much will that change? You know, we've talked already about colour and light and reflections, literal and metaphorical. How much will the ambient light, weather, do you factor that into your thinking, really? If you're looking at how the audience is going to engage, are you aware of
totally
that?
Changes. How much it'll, absolutely changes it.
Well, I was going to ask you, what's the best time of day to look at a Harold Sulberg? You talked about dusk, or could it be dawn, or is it at midday?
There's just a bit of everything. You know, he could take you throughout the day, really. You should maybe go to him at certain points. You can start your day with him, you can go at lunchtime, you can go in the afternoon. There's a lovely summer evening on the balcony, and dusk, and then you can end up at the pitch black night looking at winter night and those fantastic mountains that will take you all the way to heaven.
Well, that's poetry in promotion right there. You'd be foolish to miss it. Harold Sulberg Painting Norway is at the Dulwich Picture Gallery right through until the start of June. Kathleen Soriano, the curator, Marila Neudecker, the artist and creator of that wonderful tank, thank you both for coming to see us. Up next, we'll be hearing from the director of a new play set in the murky world of giallo cinema. Suspiria, a classic of the genre, was recently remade with a soundtrack by Radiohead's frontman. So, since it's around now that we normally play you a song, here's Suspirium by Thom Yorke.
Suspirium by Thom Yorke. You're listening to the Monaco Weekly.
Barbarian Sound Studio, the 2012 horror film by auteur British filmmaker Peter Strickland, did something a bit different. Much of that aforementioned horror was provided by audio rather than the usual gory visuals. And it gave the tale, which sees unassuming British Foley artist Gilderoy cast into the dark and sleazy world of 70s Italian cinema, a creepingly intimate reach. Our protagonist mentally unravels as he's tasked with creating sound effects for increasingly unsettling and violent scenes.
The film has now been remade as a stage show at London's Donmar Warehouse Theatre, with celebrated production designer Tone Scott bringing it to the stage for his directorial debut. Earlier, Monaco's Tone Hall visited the Donmar rehearsal space to catch up with him and began by asking when and how he first came across Strickland's original.
I don't think I saw it at the cinema. I think I saw it on DVD, so it must have been a year or so after it had come out. And I fell asleep the first time I watched it. I think I might have fallen asleep the second time as well. I don't mean that because it was in any way remotely boring, but the sort of the power of the atmosphere that Peter brought to the film was kind of extraordinary and hypnotic and strange. And so I found that I had to keep going back to the film and watching it several times over. And then, of course, you sort of become more analytical of it. And so I maybe was looking at the film in a way that I wouldn't normally view other films with such a level of scrutiny. I can't say that it made much more sense the more I went back to it, but I don't think that that's what I was looking for. And I think that I just remember sort of going about my daily business and sort of recalling certain moments or visuals or sounds that would just keep coming back to me in different situations. And for me, that's like the number one sign of an amazing piece of art, I think, that is not something that is immediately digestible and sort of legible in the moment, but that sort of stays with you and demands that you decipher it over time. And so I guess I didn't know that it wanted to be adapted immediately, but I felt that as time went by and it kept coming back to me, that I knew that sort of something had to be done with it, really.
I think it's quite interesting what you were sort of saying there, or what you were getting at about it sort of revisiting you at different times in quite kind of seared on your memory in that kind of way. Because I read something about how you work in design for productions, and you said in an interview, maybe it's not the same every single time, but you said that you read the script kind of once and then you don't really revisit it until quite near production, because I guess that allows you to go into some stranger, more natural directions as opposed to sort of being like linearly tied to every scene and every story.
That's interesting. Yeah, I get, yes. I think it's very much about, that part of my process is very much about trying to experience a piece of writing in the same way that an audience would. The design sort of does itself in a way. Like, once you decide that we're going to have a booth there and they have to be sealed in order for the sound to work, then the design sort of happens. And then you know that you're in a three-sided space, and so the sight lines are quite specific. So really it sort of does itself. Once you've made the decisions based on what the sound world is going to be, then the scenic design sort of followed through.
Talk to me about the sound of the show then, because that is obviously absolutely essential to it. The play is about a Foley artist, a sound designer. When I watched it, the sound is used so intelligently, and also down to things like the dialogue as well, this sort of flitting between like Italian and English and trying to find this really delicate balance of a character who can't speak Italian and is trying to weed his way through the dialogue, mixed in with all this incredibly creative Foley artist activity. Where did you draw the line between trying to communicate like an authentic Foley artist experience? Because you have these two characters, Massima and Massima, who are doing that, but it's done very performatively. So I guess that a lot of the sound that you're hearing maybe is kind of provided with backup tape and stuff like that. Where did you draw the line between trying to create real sound on stage and having to create something practical that could be performed?
I mean, yes, moments are augmented, but I think that just adds another layer into the sort of idea of artifice. And I don't think that the watermelons in the film are actually watermelons, and I think that's sort of interesting. You know, we tried recording watermelon splatting and it doesn't quite work as well. And so, but the way that we made peace with that, I suppose, is that everything that's in the show sonically is made by the people that are on stage, even if it's pre-recorded, because Ben Ringham, our sound designer, was with me throughout all rehearsals, and we had sound tech throughout all rehearsals, and we sort of created the soundscape as we went. And of course, the rehearsal set was almost identical to the final set, and we were rehearsing on a sound studio, so we were able at any moment in a day of rehearsals to go and record some extra content with some of the cast and immediately have it back in the room. So it was a sort of self-reliant space. Everything that you hear has been generated by the company, or even the voices, the whispering. We did a lot of group breathing and crying and stuff, and Eugenia Caruso's screaming figures quite heavily in it, and she of course was in the original film as well. Really, so even the artificial stuff feels honest and feels true, and I think it just adds another layer to the sort of like the aural trickery, I suppose, that goes with it. The performative elements of Massimo, the sort of dialed up sort of Foley, I suppose, is quite an important one, because it speaks something to a cinematic sort of legacy of silent movies, I suppose. These are two clowns in a way. This is a sort of Chaplin and Buster Keaton kind of thing going on, and we wanted to really dial up the physical comedy that they bring. So again, that's a slightly heightened sort of potentially unrealistic view of what a Foley artist is. But equally, you know, Tom Espiner, who's the Foley artist and plays one of the Massimos, when he gets in the zone and he's sort of doing a nature documentary with some monkeys eating each other, it's pretty funny and it's pretty full on.
The play and the film, of course, explores some quite sort of troubling areas of sexuality and horror and all these really like quite queasy, at times disturbing themes. The genre of film that they're sort of working on at that time, it's this giallo horror genre in Italy. It was this trashy, exploitative, in its very nature, violent, incredibly sexist genre of filmmaking. What are you trying to communicate to the audience about what they should be feeling uncomfortable about? Is it linear or is it something within themselves that they should be getting a bit queasy about?
Yeah, I don't necessarily know if it's linear. I think that one of the masterstrokes of the film is that you create the film that they are making in your mind, and therefore, you know, a limited amount of information to go with that film is important, which is why I think sometimes with the Italian, with the Foley, these distancing techniques that mean that you are kind of alone in your imagination, as Gilroy is alone in his imagination to create this sound that he has to make for the climax of the movie, which is this horrible, awful torture device. I feel like that's the sort of the most important thing, is that it's not so didactic. It allows us to sort of go to those places. There's a danger that this piece could become quite sort of preachy, I suppose, being as it is that it sort of foregrounds sexual politics of the workplace and also the ethics of art, really. But, you know, as I say, it's another one of those things that makes this film such an interesting piece of source material, because over the last 2-3 years, you know, I thought this film would be great to put onto stage because I like the idea of what sound can do to move people in a space and to collectively shift a feeling, which I don't think we explore as much as we could in theatre. That was the initial thought, but then Brexit happened, and or is happening maybe, and I was like, oh, this is a kind of like Ealing comedy about this British guy abroad and what our place in the international community is, and how, you know, miscommunication is sort of central to this sort of idea of an English guy being sort of adrift in this sort of foreign land. But then, of course, you know, Trump and Weinstein, and the film gained even more sort of richness, I suppose, and relevance. You've got to be delicate. It's two guys, me and Joel and Peter, making a story about this. And really, it is about men. It's about the destructive and toxic powers of male hierarchies and bullying in the workplace, really. And the effect that has, of course, on women, but also the man central to that, Gilroy in this case, who makes several wrong decisions and ends up a victim of his own doing, I suppose.
I don't want to get too cryptic in the design of what I saw, and I don't think it's a giveaway. There's, as there is in many probably recording studios, there's this sign above the stage throughout the whole play, like silencio, yeah. Silence. And I couldn't help but feel that spoke in various different scenes in different ways. I kind of got the impression that maybe an overarching thing is that Gilroy is essentially, he's scared of silence, he's scared of his own inner person, because he's obviously susceptible to all of this sexual violence going on and stuff. Mm. And then also there's these scenes where he fails to speak up for, as you say, a female colleague, and he's silent there. Silence often isn't that healthy. I mean, do you think that silence is an overarching theme?
It's entirely an overarching theme, yeah. It's completely central to the piece. I think it's one of the first things that I said to the company that the play is about, actually, is that it's about silence and powerlessness. I think that it is about the extent of self-harm, emotional self-harm, that a patriarchal system demands a man to go to in order to be part of it. And that means shutting up, essentially, emotionally. And that happens far too often in the piece. And there are so many moments in the piece where Gilroy is given a chance or an opportunity or a possibility of a different direction to take, and he chooses the wrong one. I think it's really interesting that you've got two Foley artists that can't speak. We're told they don't speak English, but we don't know that they speak anything. At one point in rehearsals, I came in and I said, guys, I think I understand what you're doing. And they're like, what? And I was like, I think you're dogs. They're like, okay. I was like, so you just like, can you just do that from now on? Just be dogs. But I like that they are just nothing but their profession. Like, and the same with Lorenzo, it's a silent technician. They're visions of Gilroy in the future in a way, which are people that just do their jobs. They're worker bees and maybe artists, but they are going along with the system that they are obediently adhering to without questioning. And I think that happens far too much. It's hard to break out of that thing, but I think that is the sort of issue that we're addressing in the show, totally, yeah.
There is also a lot of humour in it, which I've seen the film, and there is less humour in the film, or if it is, it's sort of much more uncomfortable humour. And that is present in this, but there's actual gags in this, which I think we should communicate, because it can sound like an incredibly dark experience, but there's light and shade. Were you aware of that as you made it? Was that a very, very intentional thing? Does humour sort of build a bridge in a live setting like that with the audience?
Yeah, you're totally right. I mean, there is the need for the piece to have that lightness, and I think it is in there in the film. And I think that sometimes when you're translating something from a film to the stage, because you're losing the physical close-up of the face, you need to dial it up. And I think in all senses, we're just sort of playing with dials that Peter would maybe in his medium prefer to sort of dial down, but they're definitely in there. And the very British sort of gags, you know, I do believe in God, I'd rather not get technical, you know, he's offering up the opportunity, and myself and Joel are just taking it and running with it. I mean, I've known Joel Horwood, the writer, for many years. We did do 4 years of pantomimes at the Lyric Hammersmith. And that's where we met. That's where we properly like got to work together consistently for 4 years straight, doing like Dick Whittington and like Cinderella. So like all the Foley sequences, the watermelon going everywhere, the slop sequences, they're all, you know, there is definitely a kind of quite basic need at the bottom of all of it to have like humour, to have your ribs tickled a bit.
Now you say that, it's so present, yeah. That sort of pantomime-esque absurdness to some of it, certain scenes. Yeah. That's really interesting. And I know that you, I think quite modestly, you said, oh, once you've sorted the lines and the sound, the design takes care of itself. But you are a designer of productions. You are known for this and incredibly respected. And although it, you know, you can't get too flexible on a live stage because there's only so many things you can do with scenery, but I just found the design of the way that everyone moved around the stage so intelligent, because you have a recording studio and two booths, and yet it's like a real dance between like each space. How long did you work on that? Were you aware that you needed to create different worlds within this sort of very everyday humdrum kind of space, really?
Yeah, we did. I mean, we worked really hard at it. We recorded a read-through on the second day of rehearsals, and on the third day we played it back to the company and we ran the entire show, and I just said, let's just block it. And so they weren't miming along with it. They were just sort of, their bodies were in the space and they could hear their voices separate from them. And I felt like in many ways that was a really useful exercise to get to the thematic heart of the piece. But also just, that's when we started to really drill the idea of bodies in space, you know, so that the cast could get it into their muscle memory. We would rehearse a new piece of content. We'd rehearse the next scene, and then the next day we'd go back over what we'd done and run through, and then we'd produce another bit and then we'd go back over and run through. So we were always recapping. I talked about each scene as if they were tracks rather than scenes, and we talked a lot about music, and didn't feel like a theatre rehearsal space because it just felt like a sound studio. And so you could just feel a different muscle being used. It was almost like people had different instruments and they were, you know, playing them at different pitches, and we were just layering up the tracks. And there are certain moments in the piece, the earlier moments, like slightly fast type sort of elements that we would drill and drill and drill and drill and drill. And then it's in and then it's done. And the guys still have license to really run and play with certain moments in terms of tone and how they're feeling on the night. But you've got this really solid structure, choreographic and musical structure underneath you to support you.
I saw a quote from you where you were talking about one of your other productions, which was actually the MTV Awards in LA. You said that your sign of a job well done was that you saw Kanye dancing to it. So I wonder if you had to choose between an audience loving this or Peter Strickland loving this, but not the same two. Wow. Which would you take?
Do you know what? Peter came on press night and it was really good to see him. From one like creative to another creative, if someone did a version of something that I'd already did, it's going to affect you in a different way, and it's probably going to bring up all sorts of feelings about when you were in that position and stuff. And you're never going to get an unadulterated kind of like, I absolutely love it thing, because there were moments he was like, oh, we should have done that in the film. And, you know, I'm sure there are other moments he didn't agree with. And so love is a kind of like difficult word. I think it's a collective experience. There's thematic content here which is difficult and political and will divide people, and people will have different opinions. But you've always got this thing of the universally affecting horror, which is that, you know, if someone's going to take a scalpel or a pair of secateurs to their nail bed, then everybody in the room reacts in the same way. And I think that is the great thing about horror and about live theatre, is that you have these moments where suddenly everybody is immersed in the same moment, no matter what their opinions are. That's what's important to me, I think, for this.
Very diplomatic answer.
Tom Scutt, director of the new stage production of Barbarian Sound Studio there, in conversation with Monocle's Tom Hall. And the play is at the Donmar Warehouse Theatre in London through to the end of March. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. The medium of the graphic novel might conjure associations with wisecracking crime fighters in leggings, but over the past few decades, it's also provided an intelligent and powerful platform for less flippant narratives. From the Holocaust to the Iranian Revolution, writers and artists have used the medium to tell some of the 20th century's most important stories. Now, there's a new addition to the canon. Guantanamo Kid lifts the lid on one of the 21st century's most notorious human rights abuses, telling, as it does, the story of Mohamed El-Gharani, the youngest detainee of the eponymous prison camp.
Just 14 when he was imprisoned, he was finally released 7.5 years later. But his story didn't end there. Journalist Jérôme Toubiana worked with Mohamed to tell his tale and expose the widespread abuses common at Guantanamo Bay to the wider world. The new book, with art by Alexandre Franck, is a compelling and shocking read. Monocle's Augustin Macellari caught up with Jérôme to find out more about it.
So Mohamed was already quite well known when he was still detained in Guantanamo. Largely, I think, because of his young age, which triggered interest in particular from the first lawyers who managed to get access to Guantanamo. And in particular, the legal charity called Reprieve in the UK, founded and directed by Clive Stafford Smith, realized that there were minors, juveniles in Guantanamo, and picked among them Mohamed as one of the first cases they defended. And Clive also managed to, in spite of the US censorship, to get some bits of Mohamed's life before and in Guantanamo to newspapers, including in Europe. So the case was known. When Mohamed was released in 2009, he was released to Chad. I was then contacted by an American journalist who wanted to write about him, but who didn't know well Chad. At this time, I was working quite a lot in Chad. So he asked me whether I thought the story could be of interest and if it could be possible to meet Mohamed in Chad. So I checked a bit around and found that it was possible and also really interesting to meet him. But then this journalist gave up writing the story, so I asked him permission to write it instead. He told me, go ahead. So I started to meet Mohamed quite a lot in N'Djamena, in the Chadian capital. And I indeed found the story was really, really interesting. So first I published it in France in a good French magazine, and then in UK in the London Review of Books. Those were actually quite long form articles. But still I realized that there was still a lot to tell, that it was only a little bit, like 10% of Mohamed's whole story. So the idea came to write a book, a world book. Gradually, the idea came to turn it into a graphic novel.
You mentioned that Mohamed was already, I suppose, notorious in a sense because of his young age, and it made him remarkable, and it made his story, his narrative, one that had, I mean, to put it fairly cynically, a lot of power for the human rights community, for Reprieve, who are trying to get these men, many of whom were detained arbitrarily, out of Guantanamo Bay. Mohamed, in this book, comes across as someone with a strong sense of injustice. You know, he leads hunger strikes, he protests, sometimes violently, while in captivity. And I wanted to ask how your impression of how he felt about his story becoming this kind of flagship narrative in the fight against Guantanamo Bay. What kind of sense did you get of how he felt about people using his story like this?
Well, I think he's happy about it, and it's also a kind of, it's also part of the justice process for him to tell his story, also in the hope that it will help others who may, for different reasons, not be able to tell their story. I think he's also exceptional, and he knows it, probably, in the sense that he was, as he say himself, a troublemaker, but certainly a real rebel, someone with a real sense of what should be and what should not be, and what should be right and what is not legal or not fair. So he's really somehow a good freedom fighter, and fighting for himself, fighting for the others. So he has this sense of being Yeah, a kind of flagship, or certainly a spokesperson, maybe would be a better word, for others and for himself. He has also a really deep understanding of the system he and others suffered from. And then, well, he was a teenager then, so that's also part of his rebel spirit, in addition to his personal character, which I think is quite strong. Well, I was asked to write other people's stories after him, but I'm not sure I could do it. I mean, I also picked him because I felt he was a very interesting person.
A lot at the time was made of the so-called extraordinary interrogation techniques that the CIA was using on these detainees, both in Black Spots and in Guantanamo Bay itself. Extraordinary interrogation, of course, being a rather Orwellian euphemism for torture. But I wondered, while you were talking to Mohammed, were you surprised at the scope of what actually went on? You know, we heard about waterboarding, and we heard about stress positions, and we heard about heavy metal or Barney the Dinosaur being blasted at all hours. But this child was also burned with cigarettes and beaten. Was this something that you were shocked to hear?
Yes, definitely. First, because, and actually Mohammed was surprised that I didn't know more about it. But you have to remember that when we first met in 2009-10, there was not that much information about what was happening. He was somehow one of the first released to give a full uncensored testimony. I was surprised by some things, and I tried to cross-check them to be sure I was not making mistakes, including on the use of electricity, for instance. I did cross-check, including with the lawyers who had access to more prisoners, and as well with other testimonies who were published at the time or later, who were gradually published. And so it's how I found that it was really that bad, and that Mohammed's testimony was particularly important, because actually he had experienced quite a lot of things that had been taken place there. I think actually partly because he was a troublemaker, it helped others, but it also made his situation more difficult.
Beyond communicating that sense of injustice that, I mean, really comes through, as we read the book, we find out that the crimes that Mohammed stands accused of involve plotting with terrorist leaders in London when he would have been under 10 years old. You know, that it's truly absurd. And his kind of continued detention is extraordinary in the face of the objective untruth of the allegations. Beyond that, and beyond the torture, beyond telling the wider world about what went on, was there anything that you felt he really wanted you to communicate through this book?
Many things, I think, including the whole complexity of the things. Of course, there are messages that is pretty good at communicating, including the fact that he really made the difference, importantly, between the American government at the time and the American people. He never made any confusion between them. But generally, I think he also left Guantanamo with strong understanding of the problem of racism in the United States and beyond, because he was also one of the few black prisoners. And while he had suffered as a child of the strong racism where he was living then in Saudi Arabia, he also suffered a lot from the racism on behalf of the white guards, of the white soldiers in Guantanamo. And he also experienced strong feelings of solidarity with the black and Latino guards in Guantanamo as well. So he certainly wanted to convey this important complexity that even in Guantanamo, he met some really bad guys, but also some very nice individuals among the guards as among the prisoners. So I think he really wanted to convey the whole story in its all very detailed human complexity.
Indeed, and it does capture that nuance. You know, one of the things that comes through is the two sides of the coin with respect to the guards. And as you say, It is largely along lines of kind of racial solidarity, although there is one notable exception in here. But, you know, these twin poles of kind of very casual sadism and then moments of real humanity or solidarity. He gets the prison manual shared with him so that he knows, you know, he has this kind of meta knowledge of how the guards have been told to behave with him.
Yeah, certainly. Well, he also has what was really, it's also one of the reasons why I really felt he was somehow a really good Guantanamo storyteller, is that he has a really deep sense of irony and humor and absurdity. So he knows very well what's really ridiculous and absurd. And even sometimes when we were discussing and he was telling me the story, we even laughed so much the whole thing was absurd and Kafkaian.
Now, the book itself is illustrated by Alexandre Franck, who has done a really beautiful job. And as I'm sure you intended, whose art kind of strikes a slightly discordant note with the horror of the story. You know, you have these kind of fairly sort of simplistic, I don't want to say naive in a condescending way, they're very powerful images, but they could be from a children's comic telling this very, very powerful and very disturbing story. And it kind of is part of a broader tradition, a very fine tradition of comics, Mouse, the work of Joe Sacco, Persepolis, that do confront these moments of real barbarity in a visual language that's reminiscent of something else from people's lives. And I wondered what your reflections are on why the graphic novel or the comic book is such a powerful medium to communicate these stories of real life.
Yeah, well, definitely they became so gradually. I mean, initially, well, the comics were for kids, and many artists kept this style but used it to tell real stories, serious stories, dark stories. There is also the idea that Mohammed was a teenager and he wanted his story to be told to teenagers from who had not this experience. So definitely, I think he liked the style, and that was important to me too. And then definitely graphic novels as like Mouse and Persepolis certainly influenced us, knowingly or not, because I think they proved that this kind of style was actually better to tell dark stories than a more realistic style. And we certainly rejected artists with the publisher that proposed a more realistic style. It was the style we wanted. It was also the style which allowed us to convey this particular sense of humor, that is that of Mohammed, and also to is Mohammed preferred to tell the story of rebellion and struggle than the stories of torture. He preferred to tell the small victories than to spend time on the darkest moments. So it also corresponds to his own sense of what is interesting and what should be a bit more kept aside, let's say, his own sense of, you know, what is more important. Also, there is the fact that on this, on places like Guantanamo, there are very few, we could not get access, and there is very limited visual documentation is available. It's only some sets of photographs which have been authorized and censored and look a bit all the same and look rather cleaner than what the reality was. So this style allows us to represent the place without lying or cheating. It would have been very difficult to represent it well with this very limited visual documentation without making mistakes.
Mohammed was released into an environment that geopolitically felt more optimistic. You know, it was the kind of beginning of the Obama era, who ran on this campaign of Yes We Can, this idea of hope, and who promised to close Guantanamo Bay. One of his legacies may be the kind of notable failure of that promise. Mohammed's life has not been easy since he's been released, as the graphic novel makes clear. But with respect to Guantanamo Bay and, you know, this new administration that we're 2 years into, who during the campaign celebrated the use of enhanced interrogation techniques and so on, what are your thoughts for the future?
For people like Mohammed, and I can understand that they could not understand that Obama was not able to just close it from one day to the next, you know. And I think for him, the only way to, first thing to do is that. And he can't imagine that it is still open. Then for his own future, it's, for me, it's really difficult to understand that the US administration is just satisfied by releasing people without really repairing the injustice they suffered. So for me, there is still a struggle to be held for people like Mohammed, who have been released, who have been proven innocent, to be really compensated so that they can rebuild their life. And for himself, the main thing is that he would need a safe place to live, a safe country to live in. And Africa is really difficult for somebody like him, who continuously bears the stigmas of the place he's been detained in. So definitely he would need to find asylum somewhere. And in an ideal world, the US should help and even should probably host him. But I don't think that can happen. But, well, there is still something to be done there. The story is not finished.
Indeed, it's not. And beyond that, you know, this period in the CIA's already pretty checkered history, is this going to be remembered as a dark period, or do you think we're going to see more of this over the next decades, this kind of treatment of individuals and this propensity for violence towards detainees?
I think in one sense it was a particular moment. It was not that representative of the United States, and we need not to forget that many people mobilized, activists, lawyers, journalists in the US and from the US against this, probably more than from anywhere else in the world. So it's a moment where the US after September 11 really became crazy. I think it's not necessarily the rule. And I also think somehow ironically that because it did not happen that well and there was much noise, now, let's say, there are, the US and other governments found other ways to imprison and to legalize tortures. Basically, the whole story is finding a way to do this, to justify this particular violence, but still having your hands clean. And they did it, as you mentioned, by inventing new vocabulary, new names for torture and for what they were doing. But they also did it for a long time and are still doing it by subcontracting detention and torture to other countries who are known for disrespecting human rights. And this is still happening, and I think this will definitely increase. This will be the trend even, I think, in the future, to subcontract the things you are not allowed to do to others who do it without much concern for human rights or ethics.
That was Jérôme Toubiana in conversation with Augustin Macellari. And Guantanamo Kid, the story of the camp's youngest detainee, Mohamed El-Gharani, is out now. And if you're in London, Jérôme will be appearing at the London Review Bookshop with the book's illustrator, Alexandre Franck, on the 12th of March. You're listening to the Monaco Weekly here on Monaco 24. Tom, it's been a pleasure.
Shall we, Fernando, thank the people behind the glass that made it all possible?
Of course. Today's show was produced by Augustin Macellari and researched by Teresa Marvulli. A special thanks to also to Maylie Evans. And of course, our studio manager was Cassie Galpin.
We'll be back at the same time next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Tom Edwards.
And from me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Goodbye.